it's worse watching bike races now that you race with all these guys than it was before I raced with them, because now you know how hard it is in the wheels of the guys in like the second group that are losing a minute every 50K.
Yeah.
And then the guys in the front, it looks so easy, you know, like when you see Wout Kern, it's like, oh yeah, he just rode away, gets a few minutes, and then you know he's going to win the sprint from that group, you know, like it's just, it seems so simple, but to stop him, like, what do you do? Unless you can follow, there's not much you can do, you know, like these guys are just unreal at what they do, you know?
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Repeat on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see, you think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today's conversation is our last recorded interview from our winter in Girona, Spain. Another Girona local of sorts, Luke Lamperti, although he and I met in person for the first time at Gravel World Championships last fall in Italy when we were on the USA Cycling team together. Actually, right in the middle of all of that turmoil, at least in the headlines for Soudal Quickstep, when there was talk of a merger and some uncertainty, I didn't envy Luke during that time, but fortunately it all ended up just fine, and he has certainly hit the ground running in his first year on the World Tour. Luke is someone who I've been following from afar for a couple of years, but it was really fun to get a couple of training rides with him this winter and hear a little bit more about what it's been like to integrate into the highest level of the sport, what he hopes to do, what it's like to explore and discover what kind of rider he could be. He's won USA Cycling Crit Nationals many times and has thus, you know, been kind of pegged as a sprinter of sorts, but already we're seeing how diverse a skill set he has. And of course, we have a lot of people on this show who have had illustrious careers, accomplished many things, and have time to kind of look back on a decade and sometimes much more of racing careers and adventures had. But it's also fun to check in with folks that are kind of just beginning that journey too. So I was really thrilled that Luke is willing to join us today, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. Before we jump into it, I do want to thank all of y'all that sent in voice memos and sound bites from your participation in Mid-South for our recap episode. Love that section of the show, and that episode has been received very well. So thank you all for your contributions and helping make it what it is. And also on that note, speaking of Mid-South content, I put up a video, which is basically the last 18 miles uncut. I had a little camera mounted on my bike, and I just narrate the whole thing. It's like 30, 40 minutes. I had no idea whether anyone would be interested, especially since I had that puncture with 6 or 7 miles to go and didn't actually get to participate in the final sprint. But man, it's been popular. The feedback has been huge. So I think we're going to do it again. We have done it again. The Santa Vi Stage 1 Hill Climb, so back to Girona here for a minute, has just been uploaded to YouTube. Same format, but this time I added some data metrics, so power, heart rate, percent grade, fun stuff like that. That was one of the requests we had. So if you enjoyed that content, head over to the YouTube channel to check it out and look for more of that sort of thing in the near future. All right, thank you all so much for listening, and catch you after the show.
All right, Luke, you're one of the few Girona residents that I've actually gone on a proper training ride with. Got one in with you, one with Lawson. I can't remember who else, but it's funny how many amazing riders there are here, and yet you still end up riding solo a lot. Like, we've been trying to coordinate a mountain bike ride for weeks.
I know, I say that, and then now you're leaving and we haven't. Like, it is funny because I've been teammates with loads of guys here. There's always... you feel like, oh, there's always people to ride with in Girona. But in the end, coordinating your days, actually you ride solo a lot or end up doing an hour at the start with someone and then splitting off, or you have these efforts or that efforts or an easy day, and it never actually works out in the end. But
Yeah. So as an example, I know you were teammates with Ben Healy on Trinity. You're on different teams now, of course, but he was rolling out from the Stone Bridge the other day on a mountain bike. I was like, oh, I wonder if he shreds with Luke.
Yeah, I do ride with him actually. Yeah. Sometimes here, not often, because then especially during the season, it's even harder because guys are in and out of races. So then it really changes your schedule. But he also does ride mountain bikes. So I ride with him here and there on the mountain bike.
Yeah, that's cool. So you've been here in town for 3-ish years. Is that right?
Yeah, a bit less, like two and a half now. I've had a place here. So yeah, call it home during the season. I'd still say always home for me is California, but yeah, I'm here during the season and the rest of the time when I am racing.
Yep. So big changes for you over the off season that have been extensively covered in the media. I feel like it's funny. You were one of the names. You had probably as many front page cycling news articles as anyone over the last couple of months, I feel like, which is very cool. But it's interesting how the media has taken such an interest in your first few months in the World Tour. Obviously you're this hype talent that's come through. But I'm curious like how your day to day feels different other than the fact that you're on a huge team now, one of the biggest, most successful teams of the last however many decades. You're doing highest level races, all that sort of thing, but you're still here in Girona, just like you were a couple of years ago when you were on Trinity, still doing big races, but more kind of on your way to earning what you have now opportunities wise. We're also laughing because you've done like, I don't know how many podcasts in the last 6 months. It seems like I was like, oh, I'm going to get Luke. Going to get a, like, not exclusive interview, but like get him on the podcast. I'm sure he hasn't done that many podcasts. And then I found like 8. But anyway, other than that extra attention, like how has your day-to-day life changed at this point now?
Yeah, honestly, I feel like as a cyclist, your day-to-day life, whether you're in the World Tour now or whether you train like I have the last 2 years, I was on Trinity before. And honestly, my day-to-day life doesn't really change that much. You know, like maybe I train a bit more hours now or do a bit more. And at the end of the day, nothing really changes. You're here in Girona and you have the same thing for breakfast and you go training. You know, I ride with a lot of the same guys that I was actually teammates with on Trinity or have known from the past. And then, yeah, you go to races and that's completely different experience now, I'd say at the race, but my day-to-day life at home is quite similar to what it has been. I might spend a bit more time actually here in Girona this year as the season is probably longer now than it has been in the past. So I was here first thing in January after the new year, and then I won't go home until later in the year, which it was a bit shorter with the last few years. But other than that, the day-to-day I would say is very similar as a cyclist, whether you're kind of doing what you're doing or doing what I'm doing. It's all kind of a similar, I feel like most cyclists live a pretty similar lifestyle with small changes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So other than trying to be the best you can and getting yourself prepared for these big, big classics, because that's what we're in the middle of right now. You had a great Kona, which we'll talk about. What's the adjustment been like to just there being kind of like more noise in your life maybe? Because you strike me as kind of more of a humble guy. Like you're not out there cranking out a bunch of steezy reels on Instagram or like, you know, titling your every Strava ride with something clever. Like you go about your work, you have your cycling goals. But in a lot of ways, like even though it doesn't seem like you're the sort of person that wants to project yourself out to the world online, a lot of people have started coming to you and there's been, you know, some different headlines. You know, your outspoken team principal, I think, name drop Tom Boone in alongside your name, like some different things like that. How has that changed kind of your mindset, if at all, and how have you dealt with just being talked about more?
Yeah, I think I've never been really a guy that's massive on social media. I've never had a big social media presence, really. I don't post that often on social media. I don't share much about my day-to-day life, kind of a behind the scenes, or like you said, I don't post reels or anything like that. I've always kind of just been one who gets on with my stuff, whatever, and does my thing and shows up to the races and wants to be the best. That's kind of always been more of my thing, but it's for sure something I need to work on now. Obviously, social media is more and more important, especially with my generation of riders and the way the sport's going. But yeah, at the same time, now that I have had more social media attention or attention from the media, it's easier to actually boost your own media when you have more attention from the media, I would say. And then also kind of, yeah, also learning to handle it now when you have loads of interviews before the races, after the races, whatever, and whether it's good or bad, you know, like the media can be for you or against you. As good as they are for me right now, is as quick as they can turn on you and also be the worst thing for you. But yeah, for sure. You have to, I mean, not letting it kind of get to you like before the race when media are, oh, today, now you're a favorite to win, or are you the hope of the team for today? What's your role? Or kind of them always trying to figure out what exactly is going on is something that you kind of learn to get on with a bit and answer the questions. But at the same time, you're kind of going through the motions with that stuff a bit and kind of doing it. Cause when it is right before the race, you're focusing on the race and trying not to think too much about that, you know, like whether the team plan is one way or the other, or it's for you, it's not for you. I feel like there's only so much you can also say before the race. Cause now it's a complicated sport that's really simple. And now everyone does look into that stuff. You know, people do watch media interviews before the race. Like you see, now going around after Strada Bianchi, the interview with Pogacar saying like, oh, I'm going to attack on Santa Maria. And he does, you know, but like for riders to do that, it's not a big thing. Like normally guys would never do it. Like he did it and it's a massive thing now, but you see how much attention he gets from just that one thing. So you do, people do have those like one-liners and clips that can be good.
Yeah. And it's funny too, though. Like that's a great example because I feel like there's a certain percentage of cycling fans or maybe even journalists who, for some reason now, are adjusting what they think of Pogacar as a person because of literally that one soundbite. And maybe some people think like, oh, maybe he's cockier than we thought he is. And they're just like changing their mind where, like you said, because it played out with the way that he just sort of nonchalantly mentioned, it changes everyone's narrative, even though maybe it shouldn't because it was a single sentence.
And that's the thing. Like you see just like the five words he said there and who knows what the whole interview was or whatever. I haven't watched the whole interview either. I've just seen the same clip on Instagram 20 times now. But in the end, like who knows if he actually was planning on it. They're not like, it seems crazy because it's so far to go. But then at the end of the day, people do see it, you know? So that's the type of thing that now I feel like you can get good attention from it, or you say that and then he goes and does bad in the race. And then everyone also puts it out there and says, oh, what happened? You know, what happened? And then you get loads of like, what happened interviews. So at the same time, it's, it can go either way.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, the way to get people the most endeared and, stoked on what you're doing is just to win races. So we should talk about your first couple of months, cause it's been pretty awesome. Going into this year, and we'll talk about this too, but it seems like you made a conscious decision to give yourself a little bit longer, not at this level, a couple more years to prepare and be ready so you could hit the ground running. And you really have. Like, I've really enjoyed watching some of the finals of your first handful of races. What has it been like to kind of discover what you're capable at this stage? Because obviously it's just this stage. You have so many years ahead of you. But if you kind of do a little bit of self-reflection about how these first races have gone, maybe give us some insight about, you know, is this where you expected to be? Is it maybe even better than you expected? What's different? What's the same?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think really short, it's a lot better than I expected. At the same time, yes, I did give myself more time to try to come in and hopefully hit the ground running. As a sprinter, I think you have to keep winning races. So much of it is confidence more than sometimes even your fitness, whereas the climbers go into a climb and you can look at your power meter and know how fast you're going to go up a climb or if you're going to get dropped. But with sprinting, so much of it is believing in yourself and making split second decisions. And when you are confident, you always make better decisions. And so for me, I wanted to stay a bit longer in the under 23s and try to keep winning races to stay successful. And then when I did turn pro, to try to be competitive in the so-called smaller races, to be able to keep that feeling. And hopefully then that translates to the bigger races as you step up in the races. But yeah, to start with the team and then instantly be successful was definitely more than I'd hoped. I'd hoped to be good, but you never really know where you're at. You know, it's a big jump in level and a completely different environment, a new team and completely new coach and protocol. Everything is completely different. So it's obviously you'd have to believe it's better when you step up to a World Tour team, but at the same time, when you change everything, maybe it takes a year to adjust, no matter if it is better or isn't better. So I think, yeah, to step in and then already in the first race I did with the team, actually in Mallorca, I did the lead out, but there a kid who I was teammates with on Trinity won, and then I was third. And like from then, I think even just that first race day being good makes you feel more at home in the team, more confident in the team. Everyone on the team can trust you more, whether it's the directors, the coaches, the staff, the other riders, like everyone trusts you more. So then it helps carry to more and more races. So I think just to hit the ground running has been massive in throughout the whole season of the team believing and me, myself even believing in what I'm doing and knowing I can be good at the level is a big, big boost.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, going third at that race after doing a lead out is pretty crazy. In regards to just depth of field, obviously that was a really early race, but everyone's talking about how like there's no race, there's no warm-up races anymore. Like back in the day, Tour Down Under was kind of this cool, like, oh, let's go somewhere warm and get the season going. And now guys are practically peaking for it, it seems like, depending. Mallorca, to an extent, seemed the same. It just seems so, like every race matters, is what I'm saying. From an outsider's perspective, how did it feel to be in that bunch? Like, I know you've done big races with the best riders, but was that depth of field wise, was that, how did that compare to some of the races you did with Trinity?
Yeah, I think it's undervalued how much your jersey actually matters in the World Tour. Like how much, like even moving around in the bunch, what your team's goal is at the race or who you have, who your biggest rider on your team is there, the team's jersey in general matters. And I think actually being in a Quickstep jersey has helped me a lot. Like you just have, I don't know, you feel kind of like a big dog, you know, like in the World Tour, they're a bigger team and you have big guys on the team and whatever. And I think that helps. So you feel more at home straight away in the peloton. But at the same time, for sure, the depth is a lot more. Like making a group of 50 guys in under 23s was completely different than making a group of 50 in the World Tour. Like the depth of strength in riders is crazy. You know, like when they say like, oh, I'll make a group of 40 guys and sprint from it. Like to make a group of 40 guys now is like, it's climbers. Like you have 40 climbers, you know, like there's not often, like if a sprinter makes a group of 40, it's massive now on a hilly day. So I'd say the depth is completely different.
Yep. So in discovering what your kit, because one of the really cool things about being in the position you're in right now is you're getting to figure out what kind of rider you are too. Because my understanding is, you know, you definitely are a fast finisher, but you also seem to have a bit more ability to get over hills as compared to some of the more pure sprinters. And there was this finish at Oman where you, I don't remember what the last climb was like exactly. Maybe you can tell us what the metrics were, but I remember some people commenting. I remember like the Lantern Rouge guys, for example, being like, I can't believe Luke was that high up. I think, was it Finn Fisher Black that won the stage and you were second?
Yeah, there was a stage that Finn won there that finished up. I think it was like a 6 or 7 minute climb, something like that in Oman. And that is actually one that I kind of surprised myself that I have. Yeah, trying to figure out kind of what I'm good at. Like I've always said, oh, I want to do the classics, but at the same time, I've been more of a sprinter in the under 23s. So it's hard to say until you really do the classics. And that's where I've been with the team is trying to figure out exactly what I want to do. Like, do I have the power to do pure bunch sprints in the tour one day? Or do I want to just go for the classics? Because it's completely different type of rider and your schedule is completely different. But I think that's what I'm trying to figure out now. And luckily I can do a bit of both and try to figure it out. But yeah, then in Oman, I also surprised myself a bit with how well I was climbing there. And I've always had a decent 5-6 minute power, but I wouldn't say like with the guys that I was with there, like on a finish, like, do I really have the ability to like finish up a climb like that? Like you can go out in training and do like a good 5 minute or a good 5 minute Strava segment. But when you actually do it at the end of the race, then it's like reassuring that you can do it. So I think, there I was climbing quite well, which was also really nice going into the classics to know that I was a bit stronger and could maybe do some of the classics this year and hang in there and actually do them instead of ride the classics more as a pure sprinter and just do the ones that are normally a 80-100 man group at the end.
For sure. So I want to keep a nice divide between things you and I have talked about on a ride together versus what we say here, just out of respect. But I know like there was potentially a team that wasn't going to pursue you as strongly, like a team that you maybe had a opportunity with, but they weren't as aggressively pursuing you anymore because they felt like in terms of numbers, you maybe didn't have like the hugest engine on paper. Mm-hmm. Is there any part of you that remembers stuff like that? Are you the kind of the athlete that uses that as fuel? And you're like, you know what? This finish that is going to be 7 minutes long. like some people are saying, I maybe don't have the engine for this, or is it just, I want to do the best I can, period. It's a bike race.
I think so a bit, but I'm not really one that like, I remember stuff, but I wouldn't say like hold grudges with people or like yeah. think about it like, oh, I really want to prove these people wrong. It's more for me, like when I'm in a race, I'm competitive in everything I do. Like I have a brother who's 2 years older and we did everything competitively. Where there was like how fast we could brush our teeth or get ready for school or who was to the car first. Like everything was competitive when we were growing up. So I think when it comes to a race for me, I've always been way different than even in training. Like if I see the finish line for me, or if I know like I have 1K to the top of a climb, like in a race for me, it's completely different than training. Like I'm always a guy who really gets up for racing or when it's competitive. Like even if it's a group ride, I'm way better off training that way than I am on my own. Like if I'm doing an effort against someone or a sprint to a town line with someone, I'll always do a way better sprint than if it's just me out on a ride and I do a sprint. Like I'm always one who's motivated with competition or competing against someone or in a race. So I think for me, that's why sometimes in a race like that, like if I know I can maybe make it to the finish on the top of this climb, like it's just another opportunity where the team's given me a chance to get a result. And I think then I'll do absolutely everything I can and go a lot deeper than I would in training per se, or do an effort that maybe I've never done before to go for something like that because it is in a race. So I think for me, it's just the competition side of it, of whenever there's other people around and people to race, that I can go a lot deeper or do a lot more, especially when I know I'm racing to win. I think if I know I'm racing to win, then I'm definitely a lot different than not.
For sure. Yeah, kind of on that note, I'm curious what it's like, because obviously you had options when you were moving to the World Tour. You had a few teams involved. I don't know how many teams. How much of that is results versus power files these days? Does it depend on the team, or like how many power files are getting sent out versus, you know, maybe a different team manager is like, mm-hmm. I just have a good feeling about this guy. And then he has to maybe like reverse engineer some, he has to like sell it to the other stakeholders.
Yeah. I think it is changing, maybe not more to power files, but they're becoming more relevant. I think the guys you talked to in the past, it was never relevant. No one ever sent their login to their Training Peaks or whatever to a team. And I think now it's more relevant maybe than it used to be. But for sure, as a sprinter, I think results are still always going to be more relevant than numbers. It's hard to really quantify numbers as a sprinter. If that was the case, all the track guys would have contracts over every World Tour sprinter. Power numbers of these guys, they do like 2,000 watts in every sprint. So for sure they would have every contract. But I think like for me, it was more results based, but for sure it's team to team. I think some teams you hear about like, oh, this guy has a VO2 of so-and-so and can do 20 minutes at however many watts per kilo and he got signed. But at the end of the day, I think for sure my style of rider, all of my conversations were more results based, and I had offers once I had results, not really from power files or that much. Like with Quickstep, I didn't send them anything. Like they didn't see my Training Peaks, one power file, anything before I signed. So
that's honestly
completely results based.
I don't know why I don't have a dog in the fight, but for some reason that makes me stoked. Like that's cool.
Yeah. I think for me also, actually I actually really liked it. Like I felt better them trusting me off of results rather than like digging through Training Peaks from the last 5 years or whatever, cause you have a massive log or, whatever it is to see what you can do. I think it is also nice for them to go off like, look, this guy's been good in bike races. We don't know if he'll be good as a pro, but we can see, you know, like you take the risk and you see, and obviously with every rider, you take a bit of a risk, but at the end of the day, if they see like, oh, you're a good sprinter in the under 23s, I think maybe you can translate it to being a good pro, then it's also nice that they go completely off of that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So take me inside of Kerna a couple of weeks ago. First proper Belgian classic of your life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. The first proper pro classic I've ever done. I did some of them as a junior, but as an under 23, we didn't have Roubaix or any of those. So it's the first proper classic I've ever done.
Yep. So on the podcast over the last month or two, we've had some riders on, both men and women, who have kind of described what it's like to be in some of these races. It was actually Petr Vakoc who gave, I thought, one of the most amazing, like I just stood there mesmerized, and it wasn't even on the podcast. We were just down in Old Town chatting, and he was basically describing all of these things that just don't show up on TV. And I'm a huge bike racing fan. I watch almost every race, like even the small races. And despite that, like there's just stuff, even when you're a super plugged in fan, like there's just stuff you'll never see. You'll never understand unless you're in the races. One of the things he was describing was just like how a lot of the Belgian roads, not the cobbled sections, but they're just like slabs of cement. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, there'll just be this channel.
Yeah.
And so you're in the middle of the bunch and you're always kind of like having to hop back and forth a little bit or just keep an eye on this tire eating channel.
Yeah.
And that just blew my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's like, literally the width, like just a bit wider than your tire, like enough for your tire to fit in. But you know, as soon as your tire goes in it, it's game over. Like, you know, for sure, as soon as you go in it, but there's always guys in the middle of the bunch, like a bit for position. It's not like people just ride a good distance. Like you would think like, oh, it's reasonable. People will just ride like on both sides of it. No. You have the guy who's always like hopping back and forth and like bumping this guy, bumping that guy. The guys behind, whoa, guys are yelling. And it's like, what? You would think like bike racing is more sensible, but actually it's like a bunch of 10-year-olds out there. Like they're all just like, no one uses their brain, you know, like everyone, but then you're doing the same thing as well. Like you say like, oh, that guy's crazy. He's not using his brain. And then like 10 minutes later, you find yourself doing the same thing and you're like, oh, I'm also the 10-year-old. So at the same time, I think when you're racing, everyone's just doing what they can to actually be their best and try to win the race. So everyone, you switch off like actually being not like a decent person, but just like using your brain to make a good decision. I feel like you just switch that completely off, you know, like you're not really in that mindset anymore.
No, it's so true. I mean, I think it's one of the things that no matter the level people fall in love with about racing is it puts your mindset in a different place. You turn into a little bit more of an animal. But is there anything else from Kerna that you picked up on during the race where you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is what it's like?
I'm trying to think of like a good story I have from that race. Honestly, we were just full gas all day. Like most of the day, we were just full gas. Like I think with Visma being so dominant now, like it took forever for the brake to go. The brake went, like we had maybe 20 minutes to go back to the car, take off a bit of clothing. And then the race was full gas again in another climb and you're fighting for position. So we had no time to like actually relax. You know, like a lot of time you see like a sprint stage and it's so relaxed all day, or even the classics, the brake goes in 20K and you have 100K before the racing really starts. I feel like this was pretty full gas the whole day. The one thing I will say, when not from this year in the classics, but some of the other bigger races I've done, you'll be surprised. Like you'll be completely suffering in the wheels. And then you'll see a guy like, I don't know, a big rider like Wout or someone, are like stopping to go pee. And you're like, it's like the hardest moment of the race. And you'll like see a guy like that, like a massive name in the race, like pull over to like go pee. And then he'll come back in the cars like 10 minutes later. And you're just like in the wheel, completely suffering. Like there's no way in your mind you're thinking about stopping. And like one of these guys will like stop and like take off his jacket and go pee and come back in the race. And you're like, what? Like it just is, it blows your mind. Like when people stop, you know, and they think nothing of it. Like some guys are just so relaxed in the races and whatever. Like you probably could stop then as well, but you just don't think about it because it's going so hard and you're like, oh, no way. But then guys come back, you know, like stuff like that. You're just like, what is going on? You know, like makes you question if you should race bikes sometimes, but.
Yeah, that's interesting. Actually, Lawson, when we chatted, said something similar because he was in a break with Wout at the tour last year. Mm. And he said they were just riding. It was the day that Wout Poels won, but Wout Van Aert was also in the break. And Lawson had an amazing day. He was fourth on the stage, but he was describing how they were just riding every single climb at threshold to stay away because of how World Tour racing is now. Apparently UAE was just like, we also want to win the stage. So they're just riding full gas in the bunch. Yeah. And Lawson said he was just like on his hands and knees, and they get to the top of a climb and Van Aert just kind of like pulls off to the side, gets in his drops and just like takes off. Like it's the last 200 meters of a race, like attacks so hard at the end of what Lawson thought everyone was doing threshold, you know, up a climb for 20 minutes or whatever. It is crazy to just know like how good you are, how good Lawson is. And then to hear that there's just like this other level, maybe not necessarily of fitness, like you're saying, but just confidence, experience. There's like levels to the game.
For sure. Like you realize like there's 100% like massive levels to the game, you know, like, and then you see, and that's why it's like, now that I do race with a lot of these guys, like seeing someone like Pogacar right away, 80K to go, like, you know how hard the guys were riding behind, like even just to stay in the wheels on the guys riding behind, and he puts 3 minutes into them. And you're like, it's honestly like it's worse watching bike races now that you race with all these guys than it was before I raced with them, because now you know how hard it is when guys go, like, when you watch the classics and it's like, they're amazing to watch. I've always watched the classics and I love watching them. But now that like in Kerna, when it opened up with 100K to go before Wout went, like, we went over the top of this first cobbled climb and I looked in front of me and there was like maybe nine guys. Like, I was top 10 over the top of this climb and I was thinking like, oh, I've made it, but I've gone like full gas for 2 minutes, like the hardest 2 minute effort of my life. And I've gotten to the top of this climb and I'm like, oh, I've made it. Like, I'm in the race. I'm in the race. And as soon as we hit the top, there's like a crosswind and I'm just like dangling just off the back of this group. But I look back and there's like no one behind me for like 20 seconds. I'm the last man on this group. But then like I look down and then like after I was going in between groups, like I sat up and waited for the other group because I was dropped. And you look down and we had like 110K to go. And I was like, we still have like 2 hours, 2.5 hours of racing left. And these guys are going full gas, you know. And then later on, like we get, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes later in the radio, we get like, oh, 2 minutes to three guys in the front of the race. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, it's just, it's mind blowing. You know, like when you watch it on TV, it seems like nothing, you know, like you see these guys go and you're like, oh, the race is starting now. It seems like nothing. But then when you know how hard it is, like in the wheels of the guys in like the second group that are losing a minute every 50K.
Yeah.
Like when you know how hard it is in that group, it makes it worse to watch bike racing now almost because you know how hard the other guys are going. And then the guys in the front, it looks so easy, you know, like when you see Wout and Kerner, it's like, oh yeah, he just rode away, gets a few minutes and then, you know, he's going to win the sprint from that group. You know, like it's just, it seems so simple, but to stop him, like, what do you, you know, like when you see a guy like this, like, what do you do? Unless you can follow, there's not much you can do, you know, like he's just so, these guys are just unreal at what they do, you know, like the when to go and how to go and whatever. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's so true. And it's also funny. I feel like when kind of to that point, when Velon or someone posts power data from a winning sprint from the end of one of these races, and it's like peak power, 1250 watts, you know, peak 22nd, 930. And there's a bunch of people in the comments like, I did that yesterday in my training.
Yeah, like, I can do that. It's like, well, yeah, a lot of people can do that, but.
Exactly. But then in the context of it being hour five and a half, hour six, and you just, you know, had like, I don't know, 350 normalized or whatever it ends up being, like, it's totally different. So with that said, did you win the group sprint at Kerna?
I didn't know. I was Laporte won it. I think I was, there was three guys up the road and then I was seventh, so I was fourth in the bunch sprint.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in that scenario, how much do you care about that? I mean, obviously there's UCI points, presumably there's a bit of prize money. Is this an opportunity to test myself? Are you like fully fighting for position like you would if it was the end of a race? Like you're in a position to win the race. I assume the butterflies aren't quite the same as if it was about to be the race winning sprint, but what was it like to be in that sprint for the second?
Yeah, I think for sure it's completely different than when you are racing to win. Like it's hard. Of course, like for me, it was still like for me to be fourth there would have still been a massive result. And even to be seventh was good for me. So it's, I would say for sure I was up for it and I wanted to sprint for it. Whereas like some guys are in that group and everyone was sprinting for it. Like I would say everyone's going pretty full gas and there's a massive fight for position, but it's not the same as if it were to be for the win. Like for sure, everyone's more up for it when it's for the win. And then some guys are more motivated than others, but for sure for me, I was motivated to do well there. Like the team had also said in the radio, like they put Askren on the front to ride back another group for me. And like, they wanted me to sprint for it. So they also were like, all right, we want to see what you can do at the end of the race. So for them, it was also important, which makes it important for me. And yeah, of course I cared about, you know, like to win the bunch sprint there, especially behind the group that was up the road would have been massive. So I was super up for it. And then I had a few guys on the team that were still there to help with the lead out. So it wasn't actually that stressful for me then, cause we kind of took it from the front. But there was still quite a few other big names in the sprint. Phillipson was there. It was, one of the best sprinters in the world last year and stuff like that. So it's a good opportunity also to race against those guys. But also it's not for the win. So if something does go wrong, you can look back at it and be like, oh, it's not, you don't really beat yourself up that much about it. Like I went a bit early in that sprint and you look back at it and like, oh, I could have waited, but I felt like it was going to swarm. And at the end, maybe I should have waited. But if you were to do that and it would be to win Kerna as a Neo Pro, like I would still be losing sleep over it. But at the end of the day, when it's for fourth, you're like, oh, you learn from it, you know, and you move on.
Yep. What's going through your head when you hear over the radio that Kasper Asgreen's going to be doing something for you, a guy that's won Flanders?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, and that's the thing with the team is they will always, like they have always believed in young guys and they will always put good guys in the race and do what they can to help guys. Like, he had crashed the day before in Omloop, so he wasn't feeling that good. And he said, oh, I'm not feeling that good. The guys were off the front and they were like, all right, let's ride for the sprint then. And then it was a good, like, the plan was always originally, if it was a sprint, they were going to help me. But then when those guys were up the road, they were like, all right, let's still just commit to the plan and ride for a sprint and go through the motions. Cause I think you only get so many chances in a year to actually go through the motions of a sprint, whether it's a field sprint, an end of a classic, whatever. So I think to go through the motions is also good of like doing it all and racing that final. Cause who knows, now I learned that sprint for next year. And if it's the same finish, then maybe you are racing it to win. And now I've done the sprint at least once, whether it was for fourth or whatever, you still know the finish. So I think for the team, it's also important to do it. So, but yeah, when you do hear the Askren is going to ride, I think it does put pressure on you for sure. Like, for sure, you do want to perform when a guy with his name, you know, he has won Flanders and all the stuff he's done. It is motivating when you have guys like that and Alaphilippe, a few guys in front of you in the lead out trying to help. And it is really cool to also be able to learn from these guys. Like, Lampard's been the last man in the lead out before me, whether when I've been doing the lead out or he's led me out. And like, the experience he has in these races and knows these races is like, what he can pass down is crazy. Cause how much knowing these races matters is, it would blow your mind. Like, if you just know the races, like, you have all these Belgian guys that they know, like, they pass their grandma's house and then they turn left and there's a pothole on the right and they attack right here and it's always crosswind. Like, they ride these same roads. And so I think having guys like that on the team is massive for a guy like me who doesn't know it as well to learn from. And they just know exactly what to do. So I think having these big names puts pressure on you, but it's also really motivating to race with these guys and have these guys help you or even ride for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I forget what race it is, but I was listening to a different podcast the other day and I heard that there's this red door. I don't know if it's Flanders, but apparently there's some red door that everyone looks for. It's like 30K to go or something. And you just have to be top 10. When you see the red door,
I believe it. Like, these guys know, like, when I say, like, oh, pass your grandma's house, like, that's always the joke is, like, these Belgian guys, they just, it's only so big. So when you train on these roads forever, it's almost like they're always racing on home roads. But, you know, like, on your favorite descent at home or whatever, you know, on the inside of this corner, like, there's braking bumps or whatever, there's potholes or whatever it is, or like the trails you ride, like, you know exactly, like, oh, if you take this line, like, a bit to the left here, like, you don't hit braking bumps into the corner. And it's the same with the Belgian roads, like, you know which side to hit a cobble sector on or whatever. And like, when you don't know that, it can be the difference of a race at the end. But when you grew up riding these roads and you've done these races 15 years now, you know exactly how to do them all. And when you have guys like that to show you on the team, it's massive.
Yeah. So how does that information get passed to you as a new guy on the team? Is it a meeting on the bus before the race, or is it someone like Lampard just rolling up next to you 10K before a critical moment, being like, yo, FYI, dude, we should move up right now?
I think a lot of it is actually the directors in the car. So the guy who sits right seat in the cars is always who is on the radio. So there's one guy driving in the right seat, they're on the radio. And it's mostly the directors actually that are calling out. Like, they also know the roads super well and they go over it all in the meetings. But to remember 100 turns in the meeting is really hard. So I think you have to, they go over it in the radio, like, oh, in 5K, you have to be in position. Like, we stay on this road 3K, then we turn right. And then at the left, you have to be in position. Like, no matter what, you have to be in the front there. And then, or if you just follow a guy like Lampard around, he knows, you know, like, you know, if you follow him in the important sections, you will be in position. But I think most of it's passed through the radios.
Yep. Makes sense. Can we talk about your next race, or is that still on the DL?
No, we can. I mean, it's not out yet, but now my schedule changed, so I actually leave tomorrow now and go to Nokra course on Wednesday, which is a smaller race. It finishes in Tim Merlier's hometown, so he'll be there doing the sprint trying to win his hometown.
That's cool.
And then we go the next day, and on the weekend I'll do Milan San Remo. So for me, it'll be my first real big classic, first monument, kind of first of a lot of things. Probably first time ever riding 300K in one day. a lot of firsts in one day.
Yeah. So the idea there being that it seems like you can get over some hills better than maybe some people expected.
Yeah. I think the idea there is I've been climbing well at the start of the year, and everyone's schedule changes around in the classics as guys get sick, hurt, or whatever. And I think they saw an opportunity. Yeah. Maybe we do put them in and see what's possible. Who knows? It used to be more of a sprinter's race. Now it's hard to say, but at the same time, if I am climbing like I was in Oman or climbing climbing well, then there is a possibility that maybe I make it over and learn the race for the future as well. It is a race that in theory should suit me really well in the future. So I think the more times you do these races, the more you learn. And even if it completely goes apart this time, you know, for the next years and whatever, the more you do it, the more experience you have. And hopefully at some point when you do it in the next 10 years, hopefully someday you can win it, you know? And I think to win it, you have to do these races a lot of times. Like, you see some of the best guys in the world still can't win all the classics, because I think it's just, you have to do them so many times to eventually win one of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's crazy even to just think about Wout, for example. Like, we were talking about how insanely good he is earlier, and he's still kind of on this quest to check off a lot of the races that in theory he can win, which says everything.
Yeah.
Cool, man. So does training change at all now that San Remo's on your schedule, with it being so long?
Not really. I didn't do anything special. I mean, I will do a fair bit of 6-hour rides already, in between, when I have longer blocks in between the races. When you don't have that racing, that's kind of the only way to simulate it. So I do a few of those, but I don't go out and do 300K behind a scooter or something like that to simulate it. Today, I actually did a bit of a simulation, kind of to do like an 8-minute full gas and then a bit of a break and a 6-minute full gas to see what it's like. But at the end of the day, it's more just for your body to get the feeling and to do the effort than it is to actually make it exactly the same, you know. And you do a bit of a time behind the scooter and it speeds it up or whatever, but you don't do anything super specific, I wouldn't say, towards it, especially when you find out a week before. There's only, now you're kind of just fine tuning anyway. I'm not going to change my fitness from when I found out to when the race actually happens at the end of the day. So you're always, this time of year, you're always kind of just fine tuning, because all of a sudden I wasn't meant to race until Saturday, Sunday, and then now I race Wednesday, and your schedule's always changing around. So at the end of the day, then it changes, but more just the fine tuning or pre-race ride or an extra easy day or an extra hard day or whatever it might be.
Yep. Cool. So one thing I was curious about is, I mean, there's so many awesome rides in Girona, especially if you're someone that likes riding on the dirt as well. I know you grew up riding mountain bikes, and we actually raced Gravel Worlds together, which we haven't really talked about, might later. Mm-hmm. There's so many routes, many routes to ride here. Do you have a favorite go-to longer day on the road bike?
My favorite road ride would be a Rupit Loop.
What's Rupit?
So Rupit is a tiny town on the other side of El Far. Have you heard of El Far or done El Far? El Far is this out and back lookout here that's kind of out towards a lot, and then you go left.
Okay.
But El Far is on the other side of that, and it's an amazing 5-hour loop. But the best part is there's this tiny town, Rupit, that you take the small road to for like the last hour to get there, and you come here. It's like cobbles into this town, tiny town, and there's a small cafe there that has like a really good box, get a good sandwich and a Coke or whatever, coffee, and stop there on a 5-hour day. And it's always just been like my go-to 5-hour like endurance. Like, if you don't have efforts or whatever, you start up St. Hilary.
Yeah.
So you go up St. Hilary off the backside and then around to Rupit. And it's one of my favorite 5-hour loops. You're like five hours endurance, and it's not super cold or whatever. Like, especially in summer, it's an amazing, amazing loop, a good stop at like 3.5 hours, and then roll back over to a lot and back into town. I'd say that's my, that's my favorite.
Let's talk about, so Lasse reminded me about Supercross. You're a Supercross fan. You come from a background where you have, so you rode dirt bikes, rode mountain bikes, rode gravel, like we're talking about. But you were telling me before we started recording that you come from a bit of a ranching family. Mm-hmm. So you're from NorCal. Sebastopol, is that right?
Yeah, so I grew up, it's an hour north of San Francisco. For people who know the area, Sebastopol, kind of near Napa Valley, Sonoma County, for people that know. And then an hour and 20 minutes north of there is a place called Clear Lake Oaks. And my family, my dad's dad grew up, and he had a ranch there. Both my parents grew up in Clear Lake, my mom on Cobb, which is a mountain near there, my dad in Clear Lake. And so it's always been somewhere that we've gone back to as a family ever since I was super young. And we'd go up there Friday after school until Sunday night. We'd come back home. Me and my brother would leave from school. My parents would pick us up. We'd go up there for the weekend, and we'd be on the ranch. So we had a bunch of cows, sheep, all that type of stuff, growing up. So it's kind of, it is good fun, but it's also, it turned into work, you know, like so much of it's work. Like, you don't realize how much there is to do on a ranch day to day, whether it's on tractors, whatever. Like, it taught me a lot of how to drive tractors and trucks and all of that stuff. But then at the same time, it's only so fun, you know, like, you spend your first hour's fun, and then when you're 5 hours into moving rocks on an excavator or whatever it is, it's boring, you know, like, then it's a job at the end of the day. And so, yeah, it is a lot of where I learned how to work and work ethic, and so much of what I learned was there. So there's nothing, I wouldn't change it for anything, but at the same time, it's a lot of work for sure.
Yeah. So what do you mean by it taught you work ethic? I mean, there's the obvious, but yeah. Was it like, what was the family dynamic like? Was it just an expectation that kind of everyone pitched in, and it's just what everyone did, and you sort of like were in this environment where everyone was working hard, and so you've just carried that forward? Or is it something you guys talked about?
A bit, but I think so much of it was my dad's dad, who had the ranch. He'd grown up forever. Like, he worked his whole life for it. Basically, that was his thing. And he always was the one that drilled into me and my brother, like, oh, we'd be there at 7 every Saturday morning to go feed and whatever. And like, no matter what, whether it's a holiday, whatever, like, a ranch keeps going, like, animals have to be fed, all of that. And so you learn, I think, so much of even just being a small part of that, and always, there's always something to do, you know, like, you go and something's broken and you fix that, whatever. And there's just stuff that always has to be done. So he was always honest about showing up at the right time, making sure everything's good, like, doing things the right way. I've always been like, me and brother would be like, oh, we can do it faster this way and cut a corner this way. And he was always the old school, like, oh no, we've done it this way for 50 years now. Like, this is how we do it. And, stuff like that. So I think that is a lot of kind of, where I learned so much of that, I think, was from him more than anyone.
Yeah. Are you a rider that likes the hard work component, like the actual manual labor component of this job? Or are you someone who trains to race and you love the thrill of trying to win a race?
I mean, I love the thrill of racing, and I love racing. Like, I do it to race for sure. But at the same time, I love the day-to-day of training and riding. But for sure, without the racing, I don't think I would, I think I would always ride the bike to enjoy riding the bike, but I don't think I would be a guy who does as much as I do now, if I wasn't racing. Like, some guys stop and they still do 20, 25 hours a week. Yeah. I think I would ride the bike a lot still, and I still love riding my bike, but I don't think I would do the same amount if it weren't for the racing. Like, I think I love racing and the competitive aspect of it more than any of it.
Yeah. Do you think you'd be ranching still, or what do you think the alternative would be?
Yeah, I didn't know what I would be doing if I was home. It's hard to say. Like, my brother raced until he did Yorkshire Worlds in 2019.
Oh, no way.
And then stopped. So he raced on the road. He was on Lux with me and
cool,
all of that. And then he stopped to go to school, and then school happened, whatever. But we always joke, like, what would I do? And now he's actually, he did real estate for a little bit, but now he's a pilot. So he flies planes all over. And like, it's always funny what you end up in. Like, he had never thought he was going to be a pilot, and now he's flying jets across the country, across the world, whatever. And like, you never know what you're going to do. And people always ask me, like, oh, what would you do if you weren't racing? Like, I don't know. My parents have had a car dealership a used car dealership in California for 30 something years. And when I'm home, in the off season, I'm always like taking cars they don't want and fixing them up and selling them and stuff like that. So I think, I don't know, maybe I would do something with, buying and selling cars. Maybe I'd be on the ranch. Who knows? Maybe something completely different. Who knows where I'd be with, if I wasn't racing bikes, but we'll see, I guess. Someday we'll find out. But yeah, for now, it's hard to say.
Do you miss all that? Like, do you miss Northern California and that sort of lifestyle? Cause I mean, living here in Europe is a very different lifestyle.
Yeah, I think, for sure I miss it. I mean, I love when I'm home in the off season and able to do all that stuff and still on the ranch and with family and, being with everyone for sure. It's hard to not have all of that, but then at the same time, to do what I do, I have to be here. It makes it harder that where I live, the riding is also some of the best in the world. So it's an amazing place to train and everything. It's just the travel. Yeah. You can't go back and forth to Europe, but for sure I miss it. But then also at the same time, I love it here. You know, it's almost like I have two completely different lives. Like, when I go back there, my life is completely different there. And then when I'm here, I'm like switched on to work and all of that. Maybe I do the small things a bit better here. Maybe I recover a bit better when I'm here and do all of that to the T a little bit better, and focus more on that. But then I also really enjoy my time back at home, and it's kind of a mental reset always when I'm back home as well, and able to switch off a bit from like feeling like I'm riding, but I can train the same. Like, yeah, I can still do all the training, but then I'm more switched off when I'm off the bike, not thinking as much about racing or the next thing or whatever. So it's nice nice to always go back and have that mental reset. And most of the people that I hang out with there don't know that much about cycling, and they don't know actually what I really do. So it's more of a, it's because they don't know, it's more like, you know, it's not talked about or anything like that. Like most of the guys, you know, here in Girona, like I have a great friend group here. I love everyone that I know here, but everyone's through cycling or lives here because of cycling. So the natural topic is cycling, you know, like you're going to go to dinner and talk about cycling or get a coffee and talk about racing bikes or what race you're doing, or you raced with the same guys on the weekend, which is nice, but it's nice to also get away from it sometimes.
Yeah. Have you found anything while here to kind of give yourself a break from that constant cycle of bikes all the time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the biggest thing that I've done to kind of get away from that is have my own apartment here, actually, has been massive for that. Like just switching off when you come back from the race, you're always rooming with guys, whatever. And then when I come back, I can switch off, and there's loads of people in Girona. If you do want to hang out with people, get dinner, have people over, whatever, you always can. But being able to switch off and have your own time when I'm back has been massive for me in between the races. And then actually going out on the mountain bike is, it's still cycling, but it's kind of that, like you're riding, but it feels different. You know, like that's still kind of the one thing, like since I got a mountain bike here, it's been a massive, massive change, and just doing easy days on the mountain bike and switching it up. And then since I got a car here as well, going out to the beach or doing stuff like that, just driving is, has been nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I saw you drive by in your tiny Euro car. And then just a couple of weeks later, I saw Lawson driving by in his tiny Euro car with his family and all the stuff in the bag. I was like, dang, this is the way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the trend. Yeah.
And he was laughing, 'cause he was like, yeah, I got to drive up north of Figueres to pick up this new dog, and not sure the car is going to make it, but you know, if it doesn't make it, it's fine. And
yeah,
we'll get another one for, you know, 3,000 euros or whatever. Yeah. It's pretty funny. Cause I mean, you can get around, obviously, like I think we've driven 3 times since we've been here. No. But I bet it is super nice just to be able to pin it out to the coast now and then, and also not worry when you have to leave it all winter that, like, I don't know, it gets stolen even.
Yeah, I think for sure it's not a necessity in Girona. Like you can walk everywhere, you can take your bike absolutely everywhere. But I think that's just like the American in me. Like you, all these kids that I know from London, like they just don't even have their license. But when you're from the US, like if I lived where I lived in the US without a car, like I wouldn't be able to do anything. Like as soon as I was 16, I was down there getting my license, so I had my freedom.
But it is a very American thing for sure.
Like you can't here, you don't need a car. Like most people don't have a car here, they just have a scooter or whatever. But in the US, you have to have a car to, like, as soon as you're 16, everyone I know is down there trying to get their license because you can actually go places, you know, whether it's drive yourself to school or do stuff after school, like see people or whatever. It's massive. And I think that's just like when I do use my car here, it's just that sense of freedom of knowing I can leave. Like if I want to go out to the coast right now, I can jump in my car and go, versus not having it, you feel like, oh man, I don't have a car. Like I don't use it that often, but when I do, it's way worth it because you just have that, like, knowing you can go when you want to go is just nice. Like you just, you know, you have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any part of you that's like, you know, now that you're on a world tour team, you're, well, I should back up. It's insanely badass to be a professional athlete at the highest level. Like I'm sure there's part of you that's still, 'cause you're 21. I'm sure there's part of you that's still, there's a little bit of the junior in you that's like, man, this is so cool that I've made it here. And you have your first real contract. You're on one of the biggest teams. But at the same time, like there's this funny cultural thing in cycling where like humility is just the, like extreme humility, I feel like almost is just the, I don't want to say the requirement, but just the cultural expectation. And there's a few guys that are kind of more flamboyant, maybe personality wise. And, you know, someone like Vanderpool has his Lamborghini deal, so he's posting photos of his Lambos now and then. And even so, people are kind of like, oh, I don't know if this is okay. This is sort of weird. And then you look at other sports. I know you're a big Supercross fan. Like other professional athletes are, you know, showing whatever sick car they drive.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Is there any part of you that, you know, having your first real contract, being at the highest level of the sport, you just want to like treat yourself to something, or are you just, or any, I mean that even in sort of like the attitude sense, like, is there any part of you that feels so excited to be here that you want to, like, I don't know, get yourself a nice watch or get yourself a sick car? Or are you just maintaining that, like, I'm about my work. I want to win races and I'm just going to keep it cool and keep it on the down low.
Yeah, I don't
Does
know.
That make sense?
Yeah,
I know it's kind of sense. A weird yeah. question.
It is weird because cycling is a sport where it's like frowned upon to show that you make exactly. money, or like everyone's salaries are hidden. Like in the NBA, you can look up like what the top guys make, and it's only talked about the guys who make 5-6 million in cycling.
Exactly.
You never talk about like all the guys who race on not that much money actually. And
yep.
I think it's a very like hidden thing. Like no one really shares their salary in cycling. Everyone's like hush hush about it. And if people do post photos of Lamborghinis or flying private, everyone's like, oh, he flew private to the race. But in other sports, it's like, oh, he flew private to the race. You yeah. know, like it's cool.
Respect.
Or like, yeah, he flew to the game private or whatever it is. Yeah. And it's like, it's a cool thing. But
yeah.
in cycling, it's always been, that's been a bit the culture. Like there's actually a lot of guys in cycling who have really nice cars or nice places or live a good
it.
Lifestyle, but you don't ever see,
you never see it, yeah.
anything about it. And I think so much of that is because they get a lot of hate for it, because that's the culture in cycling. It's supposed to be like, oh, you just race bikes and that's what you do. Like, you're not supposed to have cool cars or show them. Or if you do to show them, like a lot of people will be like, oh, he makes a lot of money. He hasn't had results in 6 months now and he has a nice car. It's like,
it becomes still, a negative
thing. He still made the money. Like if he can afford it to have a nice car, if that's what he likes, like it's also his life. It doesn't have to be about like his results in the last 6 months, you know, but
it's so true.
It's one of those things that people are like, oh, I'm sure he can't afford that thing anymore. And it's like, well, I don't know. Like I've never been a guy who's massive into like, I mean, I love cars and stuff like that. And I do have some of that type of stuff at home and I like stuff like that, but I haven't been a guy who's gone out and bought a nice watch since I got a contract or whatever. It is like now I am living my childhood dream, so to say. Like for sure it's always been a goal. You always are chasing going to the world tour and all of that, but I haven't done anything yet that I would say is like my treat to turning pro or whatever. I haven't bought anything. Like I've kept my same apartment in Girona, everything. But I will say everything I had before was quite good. Like my setup here in Girona was good. And I had enough support as an under 23 to also, I had everything I needed. I wouldn't say I was scrapping to get by when I was an under 23 to get to where I'm at now. I had enough. I was lucky to have enough before to have a good apartment here and have everything that you need to live a simple life. But I think if actually everybody knew what guys had in cycling or guys that have done well for themselves, that they actually have nice places. They live in nice places. They have nice cars, nice watches. Like so many cyclists are into watches and all of that stuff. Like if people actually really knew it, it's not that far from other sports. Maybe it's not the same as some of the other big sports, but it's closer than you'd think. Like a lot of people in cycling think like it's like they drive cars like mine and stuff like that. But actually a lot of the guys, especially in Monaco or Andorra, whatever, they have nice cars and watches and build nice houses or whatever it is and have a nice lifestyle, but it's just not shared upon. They don't post about it. There's never like a, I don't know. There's never like a house tour with a cyclist or whatever. You've yeah, never seen true, a guy yeah. like post a picture of his house or whatever. And who knows? Yeah. It's just a cultural thing in cycling, I think. But
some of it too is probably just out of respect to, cause I mean, let's be honest, the minimum wage in World Tour is really low.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's a difference too. Like there's such a larger spectrum of what a rider can earn versus other sports where a minimum wage is way higher.
Yeah. I mean, it can be hard having guys, you're sat on the bus with guys who make almost no money and they're riding for you. And you're the guy who makes a lot of money and everyone knows that. But I think that's a lot of why it's not talked about is because it's a tricky line. Cause there's so many guys that race for not that much money at the end of the day. So it's,
yeah.
If all these guys are posting about their nice stuff and then you have guys who do have to live a pretty simple life, it can be hard. So
totally.
I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, might as well talk about gravel group briefly, I guess.
Yeah.
We race Gravel Worlds together. Interesting event. Wasn't that your first gravel race?
It was my first real gravel race. I grew up doing grasshoppers, which I guess that's now right. are pretty big. Like when I was
Dude,
first doing them,
cycling
it was,
news articles now.
Yeah. But when I sound like y'all awesome. Back in my day, but when I first started doing them, I was maybe 11 or something, and you would show up and pay $15 or whatever and get a card, and they'd give you the card with the map of where to go, and that was it. And now they have cycling news articles, and a lot of guys actually show up to them. But besides that, Gravel Worlds was kind of my first, the beginning of gravel for me, and something I've always loved to do. I've always rode the gravel, whatever, and then I had the opportunity to do Gravel Worlds end of last year, and I was like, oh, for sure, why not get into it? You know, cause it's one of those things I think a lot of guys want to do it, but it's just fitting it in with your schedule. When you have one weekend off and you're back home, yeah. especially if you have a family and whatever, then you're like, oh, to go to another race. Like I'm sure you guys feel it. You know, when people ask you, oh, can you come do this race? It's like, yeah. oh, another race on the calendar. But, and I think that's how a lot of the road guys feel with gravel, but a lot of guys do want to do it. You know, like when they can fit it in, it's always, always nice. So yeah, that was my first go around was Gravel Worlds, but hopefully get into some more in the next few years. Hopefully be able to do some more.
Yeah. I mean, your bike sponsor is super into it.
Yeah.
And apparently Mohorich is doing Unbound this year.
That's what I've heard as well. Yeah. We'll
and see. I was chatting. Are you skeptical?
I think for sure he'll do it. I think after being Gravel World Champion, I think unless something changes with his schedule with the team and all of a sudden he has to do like Giro or something, I think for sure he does it.
Yeah. One thing that surprised me though is I was chatting with Paul Voss and he says he's heard that they're bringing at least 4, maybe 5 other Bahrain guys.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that, but if they're doing that, then that's a serious...
I know, I was like, really?
But I could see a lot of guys, like a lot of people think like so many riders want to go to the US that haven't been to the US. Exactly. And they're like, oh, I want to go to Unbound. So I could see guys also being like, they could throw out the idea at like the dinner table of being like, oh, we should bring a team to Unbound. And then guys, everyone putting their hand up and be like, I want to go to the US. I want to go. Like everyone wants to go. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, we could, why not take 5 guys then? Like, cause all these guys want to go all of a sudden. And then in the end, it turns out that they might actually bring 5 guys. But
from our side,
I don't know
side,
what you like, would do at Unbound with 5 guys though.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. I mean, Paul had some theories, but from our side, it's kind of like, man, like Mate, I'm pretty sure you can win without 5 teammates. Like, do you need to do that?
Yeah. I mean, you don't really need to, but I guess you could, they would help you a bit for sure. I mean, it would be nice to have other guys, even if it's a wheel change, whatever.
True.
I feel like that would be the biggest benefit is if you get someone to ride the same fit would be your best bet, but
yeah, it's so true. Yeah. Although I don't think that's allowed. You have to finish on the same frame.
Oh, yeah. So then I guess it'd just be wheels or whatever.
Gravel rules, baby.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. That's what I need to learn is all the gravel rules before I do the races. But yeah, I mean, for sure it would be, I think it's cool to see guys from the very top of the sport. You know, like he won Sanremo. He's one of the biggest guys in the sport to go do those races. I think is also, it's good for gravel, but it's also cool for the World Tour guys to see that like, actually these guys go and they don't just like win by 10 minutes, you know, like they see that, oh, that's how guys legitimize it from the World Tour is like, they see these other guys and then they're like, oh, well, it's not like he won by 10 minutes, you know, they get beat. And then they're like, oh, maybe it is hard, you know, for sure. Like, or you see like even Wout did Gravel Worlds and he didn't win. Okay. He had all these mechanicals, but that's part of it. You know, at the end of the day, he didn't like, he was strong, but in the end he didn't win. And you would think like, oh, for sure
he would win.
Yeah. For sure. He wins by 5 minutes, you know, but I think it validates the level as well and the different side of it.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of stuff outside of the fitness that has to fall into place.
Yeah.
Cool, man. This was solid. Who's your guy in Supercross? You said you have some friends that are, do you have friends that are racing Supercross now? That you grew up with?
Actually one of the kids I grew up with really close was Michael Mosman, who was racing until last year for Red Bull Gas.
Yeah.
And he's done now. He had a lot of injuries and stuff like that. So I grew up with those guys, and then a few of the other, he would be probably one of the bigger names. He was in 250s for a long time. And, I don't know. This season's been actually really good. They've had a lot of mud races, but it's been pretty tight. But now there's, I don't know, have you heard of Jet Lawrence? Now he's kind of like the big crazy. He's an Australian kid who's 18. Who's now winning 450s, like top of the sport, but he's been,
wait, is he the one that got a penalty the other day?
No, that's Hayden Deegan, who's another, like, they're massive on social media. His dad was like Metal Militia and did like X Games stuff.
Gotcha.
But they have a YouTube with like millions of followers, and I think he has like a million Instagram followers. Oh, and he's 17 or whatever. Like, he's just a big,
is he in 250s?
Yeah, he's 250. Okay, but he's been a big prodigy. But Jet's kind of the same in Australia, and him and his brother moved from Australia here when they were like 16 and 17 to race, and just like the whole story, he's probably like the most marketable guy now.
Interesting.
In Supercross, but he's winning championships and been good. So it's been good to watch. And then Tomac, I'm sure you know.
Yeah,
Tomac,
of course.
From John, he's always been good, but he's come back this season from injury. He blew out his Achilles last year. So he's been back, but it's been, it's always fun to watch, follow something different. Like it's the one thing I follow like pretty faithfully. Like I follow F1 a bit, but more off of Instagram, and I follow cycling. I watch quite a bit, but then also, I look at it on Instagram or look at results, but Supercross is the one thing. Like when I wake up on Sunday, because it's Saturday night here, I won't look at my phone or Instagram or anything. It's as soon as I click on Instagram, it ruins it. And I hate watching it. Like once I've seen it, I hate watching it. Like if I see a finish photo, then that's it for me. So I don't look at it. Then I watch it Sunday morning. Or if I race Sunday and I don't have time, then I won't look at Instagram like the whole day until Monday.
Yeah, but that's funny. So do you just record it or?
It's on Peacock.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I use a VPN here to watch Peacock. Yeah. Then I watch a replay.
Yeah.
So watch a replay, but
That's so funny. Yeah. Yeah, it's been killing me not being able to watch basketball while over here because the games are just...
The timing. The biggest thing is like the time change for sure. Is like trying to watch stuff, the time change is always... Or even talking to people. Like when you try to communicate, even over like email and stuff, you get emails like it's always weird times because your days only overlap a little bit and it's tricky, but...
Yeah. Thanks, man. I can't wait to follow. It's the U.S. is crushing it. Shout out Mateo Jorgensen, just one pair of knees. That is insane.
No, that's massive. Really, really big for him and the U.S., I'd say.
Yeah.
McNulty third, like to be first and third in pair of knees is massive for cycling as a whole in the U.S. and for them and how good they are. It's really cool.
Yep. Exciting times. Thanks, dude.
Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Luke. And if you're like me, these conversations just really go a long way in adding to my experience as a fan of the sport. You know, getting to know these riders more personally, getting to hear more about their backgrounds, their mindset, all that sort of thing just adds so much richness when I am watching these awesome races. So if you enjoy following World Tour Racing, I hope today's conversation did the same for you. And on that note, these conversations would not happen without the hard work of our editor, Lily Hardman, and our producer, Nicole Baker, who have continued to hold down the fort despite the fact that we three are scattered across the world right now. Nicole is in Uganda. Lily is in Brazil. But we're making it happen, and we have lots more awesome conversations coming, along with some fun shoulder content that, you know, is loosely connected with the podcast. The first thing I would shout out is that Mid-South video that I put up on YouTube. It's sort of like I'm calling it a visual podcast. I don't really know what to call it at this point. I wasn't even sure I was going to hit publish. I had certainly some significant hesitancy, but it seems like many people have really, really enjoyed it. And so we're going to do more of them. I just uploaded one from stage one of the Santa Via gravel race, which I did back in February, which was an 17-18 minute hill climb, mass start, crazy. So very different than Mid-South, potentially even more dynamic. 17 minutes turns out is actually not a lot of time to fit a bunch of observations and words into, but I do my best. And we also put some graphics up on there because that was some of the feedback we got from that first video from Mid-South is people want to see some numbers. So we've got some power data on there, heart rate, percent grade, all that sort of fun stuff. On Instagram, you can follow the Adventure Stash for our Friday quizzes and also some reels, some highlights from all of these interviews. And until then, we'll catch you next week with another episode. As always, let us know what you're loving, what you think we could improve on, what you want more of. All that sort of thing helps us do a better job here on the podcast. Catch you next week.